Locked On Bulls, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, a show for the most passionate fan base in the NBA. Your number one source for Chicago Bulls news and stories. On Twitter at Locked On Bulls, at Jordan C. Malley, and at Bulls _ Pep.
People have their opinion.
What other falsehoods are out there?
Well, a lot of the perception things about us.
Are players buying in, Jim?
Yes.
Fair enough.
Rebuilds are difficult. Sometimes it takes years and years. I still believe, given a really good offseason with this draft pick that we have coming and with our ability to get some veteran players in here alongside these young guys, we can make a substantial leap.
Kick back, relax. Locked On Bulls starts now.
My job is to prepare the child for the road, not the road for the child. And these guys are men.
Here are your hosts, Jordan Malley and Matt Peck.
What's up and welcome into Locked On Bulls, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, streaming live on Dash Radio every Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, 10 a.m. Eastern, 9 a.m. Central Time. I'm your host, Jordan Malley. Along with me is Matt Peck. Follow us on Twitter at Jordan C. Malley, at Bulls _ Peck, and at Locked On Bulls. Hit us up on our text and voicemail line, 331-979-1369, the place to do that. We do mailbag tomorrow, so we're going to get a lot of questions about what happened last night to Kevin Durant. On top of that, we're almost a week away from the NBA draft. So you have any final questions, you have any final thoughts leading up to the NBA draft, make sure to hit us up at 331-979-1369. Our show today is sponsored by Hotels.com. Don't hate like your friend's trip. Book your own with Hotels.com and get rewarded basically everywhere. Hotels.com, be there, do that, get rewarded. Matt, welcome back to this episode on this Tuesday, man. And it's kind of sad. It's kind of shocking. If you watch the NBA Finals at all, if you're listening to this right now, you watched last night's game. The nuance and the excitement over Toronto winning and potentially winning a 3-1 series kind of was all taken away by the fact that Kevin Durant came back last night and re-injured himself. What's going on, though? How are you doing today?
What's up, Jordan? What's up, Bulls Nation? Yeah, it's been a pretty hard evening into Tuesday morning to try and process everything that happened in that game last night. Obviously, as someone who was just rooting for the Warriors for the sake of extending the series and getting to watch more basketball, I was happy with the outcome and the fact that the Warriors were able to squeak out that win, especially after that dominant stretch Kawhi had in the fourth quarter where he scored 10 straight points. You know, it was certainly an example of the Warriors showing their resolve as a team that just has been through a lot together in this, you know, stretch of 5 years where they've gone to the finals. And, you know, Klay Thompson and Steph Curry both stepped up big, hit big shots late, and decided, hey, we're not going out like this. We want to play one more, at least back at Oracle. But obviously, you know, the injury to Durant in the second quarter just put a huge damper on everything. And, you know, we can talk about all the factors that went into that, the decision to let him play, the reaction in Toronto from the crowd, what happens now, how does this affect KD's legacy, how does it affect free agency this summer, and of course the big parallel that everybody was talking about here in Chicago last night into today is Derrick Rose in 2013 and the debate among the fan base about whether or not he should play. So I don't know if you want to start there or where your first thoughts were last night, but I mean, I'm glad that we get a continuation of this series, but it was just brutal to see that happen to a really great player last night.
Yeah, and I think with this one, with this injury to Kevin Durant specifically, you know, there was people out there saying that he was getting called soft and all of this. I guess maybe it's just because we aren't a Warriors-based podcast, or we're not a Raptors-based podcast, or we're not hearing all of those fans talking that way. But to me, I didn't see much of that. And maybe I'm just naive and I wasn't looking for it on Twitter. But if people were calling him soft because he didn't want to return, I totally agree with the takes of everybody out there that's saying, you know, he wanted to come back and play, and that's great. And that, I think that showed more than anything his willingness to fight and to be able to go out there and actually play. And, you know, there was always a risk of this happening. There's always a risk of him re-injuring. And now, just from what we're hearing, it sounds like it might be two separate injuries, the quad injury being one, and then also this now being an Achilles injury. So I give 110% credit to Kevin Durant for going out there and wanting to fight with the Warriors with their backs up against the wall, 3-1. So I guess I would just start with the shock of everybody, you know, seeing Kevin Durant go down and then realizing that this might be an Achilles injury. And for a guy that big and his age and the miles that he's had on him already, if this is more of a serious Achilles injury, you know, this could shock the entire NBA in terms of where free agents decide to go and what free agency is going to look like, and even deter what Kevin Durant's career is really going to be over the next, and I don't know, 5 years, 6 years. Look at what it did to DeMarcus Cousins.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Achilles injury is nasty, and it's one that players struggle to fully get over and get back to the player they were before it. I mean, you mentioned Boogie. Kobe Bryant also, you know, endured a pretty terrible Achilles that knocked him down a couple of pegs. It's a tough injury. People are expecting. And that was so late last night, I believe Woj and Ramona Shelburne both reported for ESPN that the Warriors feared that the MRI Kevin Durant was scheduled to have today would confirm what they believed was a torn Achilles. I'm not sure, Jordan, if you saw, there was that slow-mo replay where they zoomed in on Kevin Durant's, you know, the back of his right leg as he was making a move as that injury happened. You could see something pop back there in the way that they slowed that video down and zoomed in on it. It was pretty nasty to watch. So, I mean, if that's the case, and as we're recording this now, late Tuesday morning, we haven't heard yet word on that MRI officially, but I don't think anybody would be surprised to hear that it was, in fact, a torn Achilles, which means a long road of recovery ahead for Kevin Durant. You know, as you were saying a moment ago, the decision for Kevin Durant and everyone involved in the Warriors to let him play and say, well, you know, who knows, you could always make the injury worse if you decide to play on it, which is, you know, a common conception. That was the interesting thing to me, is that, you know, the Warriors GM Bob Myers was up at the podium and he was obviously very distraught. He was emotionally upset, talking about what happened, how hard it was to see that happen to Kevin Durant, and saying, you know, everyone who questioned Kevin Durant and his desire to play, his desire to be there for his teammates, they're wrong. You know, Kevin wanted to be out there so badly to help his team win this. But the other interesting element to that is, according to what we heard last night, doctors, you know, who were working with KD through this injury, you know, which has been going on about a month now, said that, you know, Steve, and I'm pretty sure it was Steve Kerr who said this to the media, they were informed by team doctors that the injury could not get worse based on where it was now by playing on it. So clearly, you know, either the doctors are wrong or something very unlikely happened with KD. And as you were saying, maybe it is two different injuries, a calf and an Achilles. And, you know, however that works out. But to me, it's interesting. Bob Myers certainly seemed like a guy who was taking accountability up at the podium last night. And Steve Kerr said, hey, the doctors told us he couldn't hurt this any worse than it already is hurt by playing on it. And clearly that appeared to not be true, as we saw those events unfold.
Yeah, it's, you know, I was really, really shocked by Bob Myers' post-game press conference. You know, I didn't expect the GM of the team during the middle of the finals to come in and answer some questions, but obviously you're going to have to do that with the best player in the NBA, arguably, between him and LeBron James, 1A, 1B. You do have to answer it, and this is the biggest stage, but I think, you know, the raw emotion that came from him and realizing that there was this risk, and all of a sudden now that played out into reality, it's sad, honestly. And I'm very, very curious where this is going to take Kevin Durant's career now. And, you know, this just adds another chip to Kevin Durant's shoulders, and it's going to add another reason why he's going to want to come back and be even stronger and even better than this. Like, in terms of free agency and how this is going to affect free agency, I still don't think it's going to affect free agency. Like, somebody's still going to give him his max contract. I think in terms of years and the way he wants to do this might change a little bit, right? It might change from him potentially signing a 1-1 with a team and doing what LeBron has done over the past few years and some of these other free agents to maybe saying, you know what, I'm going to look for a team that's going to give me a 4-year deal and I have a place that I'm secured and I know my money is secured. So that's where I really went. And also, too, to kind of pick up on what you were saying earlier about the injury, you know, I thought right away when I saw Kevin Durant go down and we were talking about all of these injuries, I thought about LeBron James. I thought about him this season, because think about with his injury. He had never been injured before, any severe injuries before, and The doctor that was working with him said that he should have been out for at least 6 months. And what did he return at? 6 weeks? 8 weeks, I think he missed.
Yeah.
So thinking about that in terms of timeline and how much guys want to get back, and even though the doctors are telling you, like, this is a six-month injury, like, there's no way he should have been playing basketball. So I just think about people that pressure guys into going back and playing on the floor and trying to go back early and calling them soft. Like, at some point, we've got to realize that these guys need to protect their bodies because it's their insurance policy. It's what they do for their careers. So I thought about LeBron and everybody that was giving LeBron crap during the middle of the season, saying, you know what, just get back, like, you're fine. Like, I think he's just being soft about it. All of those comments, I think, need to kind of start to go away. And I hopefully with this Kevin Durant injury now, we're going to start to see a lot of people shift their focus and say, you know what, let a guy take as much time as he needs to come back, because he's the only one who really truly knows his body. And that kind of goes into the discussion about Derrick Rose.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, I think it was Kyle Kuzma of the Lakers who had a tweet at some point last night saying, you know, fans sometimes forget that we're human too. Jalen Rose had a good take on one of those ESPN shows this morning that I saw a clip of on Twitter, where he was talking about how fans, you know, like, feel like in some way, they are owed something by these players of the teams that they cheer for. And Jalen Rose even using the comparison to say, you know, like, demanding a pound of flesh, and that these players are, if they have the time to take to consider, you know, maybe it's not a good idea for me to play, maybe I'm jeopardizing my future if I go out there and try and play on this, that it is somehow going to hurt their image. It's going to make fans say nasty, mean things about them and question their toughness and question their spirit. And now I'm starting to sound like Jim Boylan, but I mean, it is crazy. And look, I've certainly been guilty of this as a sports fan before, where I say, hey, man, you gotta play through this. You gotta fight through this. You know, one example, you know, I'll get to Derrick Rose in a second, but another one that rings a bell to me is Jay Cutler in the 2010 NFC Championship game, right? I mean, he got roasted for that. Turned out the dude had a pretty, like, seriously sprained MCL and had every right to be not on the sidelines and not playing through that injury in that big game. But I mean, he got vilified for it in Chicago. And then, of course, Derrick Rose in the spring of 2013, the Bulls beat the Nets in a hard-fought seven-game series in the first round, and then go up against LeBron and the juggernaut Heat in the second round and surprise everyone by winning game one on the road. And people are saying, wow, are these, you know, underdog scrappy Bulls actually going to have a shot in this series? And that's when the Derrick Rose talk really amped up on Sports Talk Radio and around Chicago and on Twitter. Derrick Rose has got to come back. He's got to come back now. This is the time. And not to just, you know, stand on a platform, because as I said, I've been guilty of calling out players for being soft or whatever in the past too. But that in that particular instance, and I know that the context of Kevin Durant's injury and timeline is different from Rose, but I could not believe Bulls fans who were just crushing Rose for not coming back and playing in that series. A, I didn't think the Bulls had a shot in that series regardless. And B, you want to ask a Rose who hasn't played real competitive basketball in like a year to come back in that series, throw him that series against those opponents cold? What do you think would have happened? And look, not to say that it's a guarantee that what happened to Kevin Durant last night would have happened to Derrick Rose if he felt so pressured that he did in fact decide to play instead of decide to rest, but it's certainly possible we would have seen something similar.
Yeah, that's for sure. And, you know, you think about, too, even Kawhi Leonard, when he basically told the Spurs, kick rocks, I'm going to come back right when I feel like I'm healthy enough. And
he got crushed for that, too.
Right. And, you know, I think about that scenario over the last 2 years more so than anything else, because, you know, as much as he did get crushed and he still kept his head down, stayed out of the media and is like, you know what, I'm going to worry about this and let everybody else talk and let them run their mouths. And they're going to see when I come back and I'm fully healthy, this is the reason why I took so much time to get back. But in both of those instances, I felt like there was no clear-cut answer from any of the players. Like, even thinking about Derrick Rose's situation and Kawhi Leonard's situation, we didn't hear from either one of those guys. And while the Derrick Rose situation, I think, could have been handled a lot better, and it was even admitted in his documentary too. He's like, I wish I would have just been able to control the narrative from day one about me, because then fans and I think people in the media would have understood more. And he even said he just really didn't have anybody to go to the media and just talk one-on-one with and get his story out. So I think about that with Derrick Rose. And then with Kawhi Leonard, look at what he did. When he got traded to Toronto, Toronto was all in. They were all in and saying, you know what, we're going to manage your time and we're going to do exactly what it's going, what it's going to be in your best interest to do. And that was sitting him for what? What did he sit? Yeah. 25, 30 games this season in order to be fully healthy? Not even just coming off the injury, but fully healthy for the playoffs too. So,
well, I was just going to say, he had a sit-down interview with Rachel Nichols that aired earlier this week, and he was saying that the fact that the Raptors let him do that and dictate, this is how I'm going to treat my body this season, I'm going to save myself for the playoffs, and I mean, it worked. He basically told Rachel Nichols, you know, Kawhi's a pretty soft-spoken guy, he doesn't say a whole lot, but in that interview I thought that was pretty interesting, because everybody's saying, man, look at like MVP level Kawhi and what the Raptors have been able to do, breezing their way through, you know, the Eastern Conference, and now getting the Warriors, the two-time defending champs, on the ropes, on the verge of breaking up a dynasty. Would this all be happening if Kawhi had been pressured and fallen into those pressures to play all 82 games this season?
Right, exactly. And, you know, this is just going to – it has a ripple effect to it, not just because of free agency and what these players are going to do, but, you know, the conversation going into the regular season next year and beyond that is going to be how many teams are going to take a good hard look at what happened to Kevin Durant and happened to Kawhi and even happened to Derrick Rose and say – you know what, if we need to manage his time and he's going to have to sit 25 or 30 games during the regular season in order to keep him healthy and keep him happy, maybe that's something we're going to do, but that's going to have a complete shell shock to fans who are buying season tickets for these games and going to these games. And, you know, that was a huge issue too, is having these superstar athletes sit in the middle of January or February or even in March when fans have paid good money to go to these games and want to see their stars play. So there's so many factors that are going to go into this. I'm just very curious to see how this is going to play out, not only with the NBA, but their owners specifically, and also, you know, future star players and how they, when they get hurt, how they're going to deal with it. It's maybe similar to Kawhi. I don't know. Maybe similar to Kevin Durant. Maybe similar to LeBron James. Any of these scenarios. So it's going to be very, very interesting. But, you know, thoughts with Kevin Durant right now, and hopefully he gets back and he's going to turn to true form again at some point. But I think the reality right now is we may not see Kevin Durant all next season.
You know, hopefully it's not that bad. But, I think everyone has to take a deep breath and prepare for the fact that the NBA just might not have Kevin Durant next season, which would really suck. Who's to say that he might not just say, you know what, I've got this $31.5 million player option. I can just be a cheerleader for my Warriors teammates here and stick around for another year. And just, you know, the Warriors certainly owe Kevin Durant that money. He's gotten them two more titles. People saying that, oh, they could win without him. Well, look how hard that's been. And he was clear-cut the MVP of the last two finals that they won. So maybe we see that. But just to go back and put one last thought on the relationship that exists between these players and the fan bases who support them, and as you were saying, players who sit and fans, as we were talking about earlier, feeling like they're owed something by these players, and maybe part of that is, you know, I spent my hard-earned money to rep this team, buy their merchandise, buy tickets to their games, and it sucks when the players that I pay to see are sitting on the bench getting rest instead of out there on the court playing, and that does suck. But I think whether you're talking about Kawhi or Kevin Durant or Derrick Rose, and, you know, KD and Derrick especially, that phrase that has gotten fans just so worked up is cleared to play, right? That is what had Bulls fans who were just grinding on Rose. That was their motivation. That was their reasoning for saying, hey, he's soft. He's been cleared to play. He should go out there and play. Kevin Durant, you know, Bob Myers sitting in there at the podium yesterday saying the doctors cleared him to play. And just because a player has been cleared to play, does that mean he should play? And what exactly is the relationship between who is leaking that information to the media, right? Because as you were saying, Derrick Rose said that he wished that he could have handled that situation better, maybe been in control of that situation a little bit better. The team told the media that the doctors had cleared him to play. So maybe that was the team putting pressure on Rose to play. And maybe Kevin Durant was getting some pressure from his team to play because we're on the ropes in the finals. We need you, buddy. And that phrase that like gives fans the right to say, hey, you're soft. The doctors say you can play, go play.
Yeah, and I think with that too, it's, you know, it causes fans to pick sides, and that's just not fair. And same thing with teams. I think sometimes they think about their best interest instead of the player's best interest. And then you see like all the hot takes last night too, which I just had, you know, I had to close out Twitter last night after reading through about half a dozen of them because I just couldn't take it. People saying, you know, they need to have an investigation into the Warriors and all of this. It's like, to me, there's two parts to this. There's the Warriors, of course, wanted him to play and with their backs up against the wall 3-1. But also, too, there's a part, too, that Kevin Durant is he is not just a Warrior in the sense he plays for the Warriors, but he's also a basketball Warrior. It's like he, out of anybody else, one of the most competitive guys in this game is going to want to go out there and play and try to give it a go. Like, that's another element to this, too. So I don't think necessarily maybe Kevin Durant's so pissed off at the Warriors, and maybe we'll find out in the coming weeks. But from what Bob Myers was saying, it was a collaborative decision to let KD play, and I'm sure he was a part of that conversation too when asked, like, do you feel okay going? Like, this is what your injury is. Here's some of the risk. Are you still okay and comfortable to go? And I'm sure he said, yes, I want to try. So I give him all the props in the world for saying that he wanted to go out there and try at least. But in terms of his money, I don't think this is going to affect his money. It's just going to be that much harder to get back to the level that he was at if he can ever get back to that level. So yeah, shout out to Kevin Durant again. Before we get on to Coby White, and we're going to talk a little bit more about Coby White because we didn't get to dive into him fully like we did with some of the other prospects we did. We got hung up talking about some other stuff yesterday, which was a great episode. We got to talk about Rajon Rondo and his one-on-one and a few other stuff. But Matt, I wanted to quickly just touch on the game itself, Game 5, after Kevin Durant left the game. That second half was so much fun to watch. And specifically, I have to just go to the last play of the game right away. The defensive set that the Warriors ran in that final play was absolutely unbelievable. You know, between Klay Thompson basically smothering Kawhi Leonard, and then you had Sean Livingston smothering Fred VanVleet, and then all of a sudden you see Andre Iguodala come up and on a super smart play being able to double team there, and then they kick it out to Kyle Lowry in the corner, and Draymond Green comes off of Marcus Gasol and actually tips that shot at the end. So a lot of people right away were giving shit to Kyle Lowry, but in fact, Draymond Green got a hand on that. So shout out to the Warriors for that unbelievable defense after making some really bonehead plays in the final 2 minutes.
It was huge. It was a big defensive stop. It's always fun to see. Obviously, everybody loves the buzzer beaters, and you know Kawhi had that one in Game 7 to knock off the Sixers, which was crazy drama with several bounces off the rim. And you had Dame's earlier in the playoffs. Everybody loves a good buzzer beater. But a great defensive stand on the final possession of a game to me is equally entertaining. And, you know, as you just pointed out, all the facets to it, you know, you had Klay and Iggy trapping Kawhi, basically giving him nowhere to go. Kawhi said after the game when someone asked him, you know, why didn't you take the last shot? Kawhi was like, dude, did you see? Like, you know, they doubled me. They smothered me. I had nowhere to go. And then Draymond, like the positioning he was able to get on Marcus Gasol, who Iggy was like, all right, Dre, you keep an eye on Mark. I'm going to go double team Kawhi. And the way that Draymond was basically able to block off a potential lob kind of entry pass to Gasol and at the same time get out to the perimeter to contest that shot against Kyle Lowry. It was just great defense from a Warriors team that we have known to be a great defensive team at times, but they certainly have not been as dominant on the defensive end this season and in these run through the playoffs. The Raptors have been the team that are impressing everyone with their defense in this series, but when the Warriors needed a defensive stop last night, do or die, they got one. And then as for Lowry, who did have that shot blocked by Draymond, you know, obviously, Lowry gets crushed on NBA Twitter, and some of it is deserved and some of it is not. And the really sad part for him is that he was playing probably one of his better games of this series and of these playoffs last night. He was hitting shots. He was finding teammates. He was getting good looks at the hole. He was knocking out outside shots. But in that stretch of the final couple of minutes, he had that really ugly turnover where he just kind of like threw the ball away to nobody when he was driving down the lane. And then he also, before having that shot blocked, he also missed a wide open corner three. So it's really unfortunate for Kyle Lowry that a game that he could have, you know, Kawhi was the one who went on a 10-0 run by himself and let the Raptors temporarily seize control. So he obviously would have gotten the bulk of the glory. But Lowry would have certainly helped his legacy if they had won that game last night and he hadn't had a costly turnover and then, of course, had made a finals clinching shot at the buzzer instead of having it blocked. And it's just a real, you know, it's a real shame. We'll see. Maybe Kyle Lowry still plays the hero at some point in this series, but for a guy who, you know, takes a lot of heat for showing up small in the big moments, he had a great game all the way up to the final minutes, and then it just kind of fell apart for him there, which was tough to see. But, I mean, also, you got to question what Nick Nurse was doing calling that timeout. They were in the middle of a run. They had the Warriors on the ropes. The Warriors only had one timeout left, and Nick Nurse, with about, like, 3.5 minutes left, decides to take a timeout and said at the podium afterwards, like, well, you know, I wanted to give our guys a break. We looked a little tired out there. You know, allowed the Warriors to regain their composure and take a breather too, and then the Warriors finished the game on a 9-2 run.
Yeah, that was the craziest part, is that the Warriors came back and made that run, but then they turned the ball over. I don't understand why guys go to the half court line when they're bringing the ball up and then want to take a pass there. Draymond Green turned the ball over, what, two or three times doing that, going backcourt violation? Like the one where he was coming across court and it went off his foot and then back into the backcourt. I think that was earlier in the first half, but then in those final minutes, he turned the ball at a crucial point. And then to DeMarcus Cousins. Man, I don't know what he was thinking on that final play, man. I mean, the Raptors had a chance to win that, and that could have been solely on DeMarcus Cousins for that final play where he stepped out and kind of hip-checked Fred VanVleet. It's like, dude, what are you doing? Like, you have to understand the time and the place, and they're lucky that the Raptors didn't get off a shot, and they played a really good defensive set there. Otherwise, people would be crushing DeMarcus Cousins for his final 2 minutes in the game because he made two critical mistakes there, and same thing with Draymond Green, but they were able to hold it off with their defense. But shout out to Klay Thompson and Steph Curry.
Not just the hip check, but that goaltend he had. Which, you know, he's trying to make a block. He's trying to make a block in a big moment in the game, and so I don't necessarily fault him for that.
Agreed. And then, you know, I think the refs got the call wrong at first when they called the ball, you know, when they were checking the replay for the cylinder, over the ball over the cylinder.
Oh, on Boogie's putback. Yeah. I thought that one angle in particular showed that it was clearly outside the cylinder. I thought that was a bad call. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I thought it was a really bad call too, but the call on the floor was that it was a violation, and the only thing that they could do is either they had to have indisputable evidence in order to overturn it. But they were talking on the broadcast too about changing to international rule where once it hits the rim, it goes live. I think they should definitely 100% take a look at that this offseason and see about changing that rule because it is so stupid. Like guys that are going up to put a putback in like that could have been a game-changing outcome there, too. If DeMarcus Cousins was able to put that ball back in, you know, we wouldn't have had that last play at the end. So there's critical points where that I think that's going to come into play, too. So they should definitely look at that rule and maybe look to change it towards the international rule, which a lot of people have been in favor for. But, yeah, I mean, the call on the court, it looked like, and there was two different angles, too, to it. One looked definitively like it was outside the cylinder, and the other one was like, I don't know if it was still touching, like, just a little bit or not. But, yeah, crazy final 2 minutes in this finals game. So going back to Oracle, at least the Warriors will get in one last game at Oracle. And could you imagine if it ends up being the very last game at Oracle and the Raptors end up winning the NBA Finals on that home floor? Oof. That would be kind of devastating for Golden State.
Brutal. I mean, man, that would be rough. And that's why, look, I know that they're deflated without Kevin Durant, and you know, the Warriors are gonna have to, you know, strap up and get themselves mentally prepared for this game, emotionally prepared for this game, which won't be easy. And you know, they were talking about wanting to win that game last night for Durant and, you know, show him that they, you know, that they're tough and that we're going to go out and get a W for him because he went out there and did everything he could for them. I picked the Warriors to win last night just because I thought that, you know, that as undermanned and hurt and depleted as they are, they're too good of a team. They're three-time champions. I didn't see them going out like that, even facing a hard game five on the road of staving off elimination. And they barely got it done. And they needed the 11 points that Kevin Durant gave them before he got hurt. I mean, there's no logical reason to pick the Warriors to win in game six. The Raptors right now are the healthier, deeper, better team, and Kawhi is playing like an MVP. I'm still taking the Warriors to win game six and force a game seven because they're the Warriors and they're at home. They did not win game three or four at Oracle in this final series. Can you imagine the Warriors failing to win a home game in the finals and losing the final game of their season and the last game ever to be played at Oracle? I can't see them going out like that. I really can't.
Especially with the caveat now of Durant's injury and, you know, that type of momentum and everything that happened, it can go two ways. It can devastate a team and they all fall apart, or it can bring them all together. So I think that's going to be a very, very interesting. And, you know, the storylines going into game six are going to be unbelievable. Yeah, I can't see it either, though. Like, losing three games at Oracle in the finals and the final game being a NBA championship for the Toronto Raptors, potentially. So we'll have to find out. Interesting thoughts. If you guys have thoughts on the NBA Finals or how Kevin Durant's injury is going to affect the NBA as a whole or free agency this summer, hit us up at 331-979-1369. So we're going to get on to Coby White now. We want to talk a little bit more in depth about his actual game and how he compares to some of the other point guards in this draft. But before we do that, our show is sponsored by Grip 6 Belts, ultra white, lightweight with no holes, no flaps, and it's a great Father's Day gift. Go to Grip 6 at grip6.com and they have a special offer for you. So grip6.com/LOCKE for your special offer, only available for our Locked On podcast listeners. So that's grip6.com/LOCKE for your special offer. So, Matt, we got into Coby White yesterday just a little bit, but we were talking a little bit more about comparisons and how we would feel if the Bulls actually drafted him there. And we were talking a lot about the comparisons of taking the risk on Coby White as opposed to taking the risk maybe on Cam Reddish or DeAndre Hunter. But let's get more specifically into his actual game. And the first thing that I thought about when I was thinking about positives of Coby White's game is the three-point shooting. You know, that's the one thing that we've been complaining about for a very long time on this show. And Coby White has shown that he can knock down the three and knock it down at an NBA level. If you go back and watch some of his films, he's taken some deep-ass threes for North Carolina last season. And that makes me more excited than ever because, you know, you see three-point shooters who come from the from college basketball into the NBA, and all of a sudden it takes an adjustment period of maybe 2 or 3 years, and sometimes guys don't ever adjust to the three-point line in the NBA compared to college basketball. But I really like what I saw from Coby White in terms of his three-point shooting, and I know the one weakness too that we talked about yesterday was the shot release and having a low shot release, but it seemed to not affect him that much in college. I mean, he was a 35.3% three-point shooter, so I really, really like that about his game, and having another guy that can shoot threes if the Bulls take him at seven would be nice. I mean, you're talking about all five starters at one point. If Coby White becomes a starter on this Bulls team, being able to knock down threes at a pretty high clip, that's pretty damn amazing. We haven't seen that in a very long time.
Well, and that is also making the assumption that Wendell takes another step forward, because we didn't really see him shoot the three with regularity at all in his rookie year. You know, we all know that he was a competent three-point shooter at Duke his one season there when he did shoot, which was not frequently. I think he only took like 40 threes the entire season. And that was pretty similar with his rookie year with the Bulls. He didn't shoot a lot of them. And he can knock them down, but hopefully he continues to work on that element of his game. I'm with you. I do think that Coby White can be a reliable at least a threat behind the three-point line, especially as you were saying, you saw him knock down some long ones, some more NBA-level three-point line kind of shots at UNC. I'm much more confident in his catch-and-shoot ability, especially when he has the half a second he needs to set his feet. When he gets his feet set and he's in, you know, he's a catch-and-shoot positions, he knocked them down really consistently. He's less consistent trying to pull up off the dribble, and I think that that's because, in general, That stems from one of the weaknesses to his game, which I kind of have an issue with, which is sometimes he can be kind of a head down dribbler. And sometimes that affects his drives to the hoop, where he loses focus and instead of finding a teammate, just drives into the trees and loses the ball. He also takes a lot, you know, he gets duped into a lot of charges because I think his feet are faster than his head a few times. And sometimes that also affects his ability to be a good pull up shooter because he's just a head down dribbler, and that can be a problem sometimes.
I agree with that, and I think the ball handling thing is going to be a little bit of a weakness in his game coming into the NBA, but a guy that doesn't necessarily have to stick at point guard, and I would hope that if they draft Kobe White at 7, that he doesn't have to necessarily always stick at point guard. You know, the way that we were talking about Malcolm Brogdon and being able to play the 1 and the 2, with Kobe White's size at 6'5", like, you're talking about Chris Dunn's size, a little bit bigger than and a little bit longer than what Chris Dunn is right now. And the fact that he can come off, like you were saying, and be able to catch and shoot at a pretty decent clip would be able to maybe interchange some things that they're going to do on the offensive side of the ball with Zach LaVine. And that makes me a little bit more excited about Kobe White's game. The other thing, too, that you brought up yesterday that I didn't get to touch back on, but I want to circle back to it, is the assist percentage. You said that Kobe White had a 24.4 assist percentage last season. That was good enough for 6th in the ACC last year. Ty Jerome was number 2, who's also an NBA prospect, NBA draft prospect. Nikhil Alexander Walker had a 24.6 assist percentage. That was good for 5th in Virginia Tech. He's looking like a first rounder as well. But some other guys, too, that followed on this list. Kobe White was at number 6. Trey Jones was at number 8 at 24% for Duke. And then also RJ Barrett, too, at number 10 at 23.5. So there was a huge knock on it. And in The Athletic, Sam Vecini breaks this down and says that coming into college, one of the biggest knocks on Kobe White's game was the fact that he would get shot happy and that he would be kind of a, I think there's a nicer term to put it, but basically, frankly, he was kind of a ball hog and wanted to take all the shots when he had the ball in his hands. But now you're seeing that at UNC that wasn't the case. 24.4 assist percentage. He was able to find guys on his team, and maybe that's just quality of players, too, around him. So Kobe White coming to this Bulls team, I think having all those shooters around him, like Lauri Markkanen, Zach LaVine, and Otto Porter Jr., is definitely, definitely going to help. And I think you're going to see that assist percentage sort of stay somewhere around maybe 20-24%, and that would be tremendously helpful for this Bulls team.
I mean, I look at the 24.4 assist percentage, and to me, it's a worry. It's not a good thing. Look, you rattle off some of his, you know, his competition in the ACC, one of the other lottery guys, RJ Barrett, who didn't have that high of a assist percentage. But guess what? People are knocking RJ Barrett for being a player with tunnel vision who dribbled too much and took too many shots. So, I mean, I think it's pretty clear cut that Kobe White is going to be more of a attacking score first point guard than a pass first point guard at the NBA, at least as he comes into the league. But you rarely see guys develop into facilitator point guards who come in with the knack of I'm a scoring point guard, or just I'm a scoring guard in general. So I'm with you. It's nice that Kobe White has some of the tools that look like he could pair nicely with Zach LaVine in the backcourt, and not necessarily be asked to be the primary ball handler and facilitator at all times, because we did see LaVine have a pretty nice uptick in his assist percentage and his assist numbers this season. Pretty significant compared to the, you know, previous 4 seasons that he'd played at the NBA level. To me, though, it's like, you know, what do you want most from Kobe White if he's the guy that the Bulls take? Do you want him to be a guy who can play off the ball and knock down threes as a catch and shoot guy, who can also attack the basket and you know, use some of his quickness with the ball to get to the rim and attack and be a score first guy? Or do you want him to be a facilitator? You know, and I think those who would rather see the Bulls having a pass-first facilitating kind of point guard are the ones who are really interested in these Lonzo Ball rumors that are going on right now. But with Kobe White, I mean, you can work on that element to your game and eliminate some of those mistakes of having tunnel vision. I think you can correct that as you move forward in the league. But to me, like, if you're asking Kobe White to be a guy who's going to dish out 6 or 7 assists a game as a rookie, I think that's far from reality.
I think so too, and I think, like you said, and I think that's a good point, is him coming in, I think, is going to lean more towards the fact that he's going to be a score first type of point guard. And, you know, we said he can knock down the three at a pretty decent clip, and when he gets on fire, he gets on fire. But the only thing that kind of worries me, just kind of going back to look at his most recent games, you know, after the new year turned, going to 2019 when he went into conference play, was the fact that he had a lot of games where he was 0-for from three-point land, specifically talking about 6 or 7 games in the last 2 months of the season where he was straight up cold, and that could have just been a shooting slump more so than anything else. But I think that's what you're going to see, is you're going to see more of a score first type of point guard. And I don't think necessarily you need to ask too much of him in his first season, because we're still talking about signing a veteran point guard that can be your stopgap starter. So if anything, he can learn stuff off the bench, and maybe depending on who they bring in as their veteran point guard can teach him a little bit of the ways. And so I think that's going to make things even more critical in terms of if they draft Kobe White, who they bring in to be your veteran point guard to start, and how they're going to be able to teach some of these young guys, you know, not even just Kobe White, but guys that the Bulls may keep hanging around, like Shaq Harrison or Ryan Arcidiacono, and even if Chris Dunn's still around by training camp time, like somebody who's going to be a veteran presence and also be able to help teach these guys some things that maybe they're lacking in their game. And so I think it makes it even more critical about who they end up signing this offseason in free agency and how they're going to be able to help develop these point guards.
Yeah, development's key. The other thing that I would say Kobe White needs to work on as far as development when he makes the jump to the NBA, he's pretty confident handling the ball and driving right. When he drives left, he still ends up taking shots with his right. He's not very comfortable finishing with his left. Now, if it's transition and he's got a lot of space, he can finish with his left. But if it's tight quarters and he's trying to drive left, you'll see a lot of times he'll just kind of take this weird, like, you know, mid-range floater looking shot with his right driving left. It gets blocked a lot. He ends up getting called for charges a lot because he's not as confident driving in that direction, which, look, a lot of young players have that issue where they're certainly more, you know, they're more confident and they're stronger driving one direction rather than the other. But with Kobe White, it's pretty glaringly clear that if defenses try to force him left, he doesn't have a whole lot in his arsenal to combat that right now. And he also can't rely on great leaping ability or athleticism to overpower that and say, well, I'll find a way to get to the hoop when I drive left because I can just outjump this guy or, you know, or outmaneuver this guy. Because I don't see him as a guy that has great body control. I already talked about, you know, the charges he takes when his feet move faster than his head. But the other thing you see is that he didn't do standing vertical and, you know, max vertical leap at the combine. He didn't do any of those numbers, so we don't have that to compare to based on some of the other people in this draft class. But just based on the tape and based on what people say about him, you know, and it's pretty easy to observe, he doesn't have great leaping ability. Like, Kobe White is not a jump out of the gym kind of guy. So if you don't have that and you don't have the confidence and the confidence in your mechanics to be a guy who can drive in all directions, then he's got to get better at that. And driving left and that floater he uses when he drives left is hard to watch.
We've got a lot of guys on this Bulls team right now that love that floating shot, like Denzel Valentine and Chris Dunn specifically. Both of those dudes love that drive to the basket, kind of either that or step back and a little bit of like a one-handed floater. We see Denzel Valentine do that all the time. Back in 2017-2018, he was doing that all the time, and it seemed like he was knocking it down. Like, every time he would take that shot, it's like, how the hell did Denzel Valentine make that shot? So if it works for him, I don't necessarily mind it, but I don't think you can bank on consistently adding in terms of your strengths as you're shooting is a little bit of a mid-range, like 6 to 10 feet type of floater, especially for a guy in Kobe White's size. Like, I know he's listed at 6'5", but going to the basket when you're going up against dudes like, I don't know, look at, for example, in this finals, look at Steph Curry trying to go to the basket, and Serge Ibaka and Marc Gasol and Pascal Siakam and Kawhi Leonard are just just absolutely destroying him around the rim. So, yeah, I would like to see him get a little bit more creative when he goes to the basket. But the good thing about him is he's a really good free throw shooter when he does get to the line. He shot 80% from the free throw line with UNC last year in his sole season. So that at least isn't a concern, Matt. At least this is a point guard that can shoot some free throws when he does get to the line.
Yeah, and he got to the line 3.7 times per game last season, which, you know, doesn't sound like a whole lot, but that's only in, you know, 28.5 minutes per game. When you're doing his per 40 stats, he shot 5.2 free throws per 40 minutes. So, that doesn't sound like anything all that exciting, but then you think about some of those ridiculous stats that we were going over as far as the absence of Chris Dunn free throw attempts last season. You remember that stretch where he had like zero free throw attempts over the span of like 14 games? And you're like, how the hell does your starting point guard go 14 games without shooting a free throw? Like, not even a tech in there somewhere from one of your opponents. Like, what the hell? How is that actually scientifically possible? But, you know, obviously, I'm with you there. I think he can have the confidence to be a guy who attacks the rim and gets to the free throw line. And he actually did show at times at UNC to be a guy who can finish through contact. He's not super strong, but he can, and especially, again, this goes back to, you know, lefty-righty. When he was driving right and taking contact and creating contact, there were a lot of really impressive and-ones that Coby White had on his reel. And so you like to see that, because that was one of Chris Dunn's biggest weaknesses, is finishing at the rim and getting to the rim. But again, with Coby White, it's all going to come down to, can he find the ways to still be the guy who has that extra burst of foot speed to beat his guys off the dribble, which he can do very well, but also not get too ahead of himself and end up getting offensive fouls against the trees once he gets to that second line of defense. Because I think that's the court vision problem with Coby White right now. Not only does it need to improve as a passer, but even as a guy who's going one-on-one, sometimes his court vision is only that first level deep. And once he beats his first guy off the dribble, he doesn't see those trees waiting for him that are coming from the weak side to help, and ends up taking a lot of offensive fouls. So, yeah, he can finish at the rim, but he's got to avoid those mistakes and those moments where, hey, you finish through the contact, but, you know, the call's going the other way.
I completely agree with that. Man, just to go back to the assist percentage for a second. So, Basketball Reference, they are kind enough to put together a assist percentage career leaders and records. And this just goes back to 2009, 2010. And out of 250 players listed, Kay Felder, former Bull, number four on this list from 2014 to 2016 at Oakland, 43.13 assist percentage. Ja Morant actually comes in at number five in his season 2018 to 2019, in his two seasons, he had a 42.98 percentage. But the funny thing is,
pretty sure Trae Young is high up on that list too, right?
Trae Young is, yes, somewhere between, let's see, I can't even find him right now, but he is on this list. The funny thing is, though, is Chris Dunn's at number nine.
Chris Dunn, yep.
Number nine,
yeah.
Michael Carter-Williams is at number 15. Cameron Payne is on this list.
Oh, God.
Cameron Payne is on this list. Denzel Valentine is also on this list. There's a lot of guys. Denzel Valentine at 236 out of 250, and he had a 29.55 assist percentage, and that's going over 4 years. So that's actually pretty impressive for Denzel Valentine. But yeah, some of these other guys.
Well, he played a lot. He played a lot of point for that Michigan State team.
That's true. But I just found it funny that there are six or seven guys that the Bulls have had recently. Jerian Grant, 126, 31.89% assist percentage at Notre Dame from 2012 to 2015. Oh, Tyrese Hughes, 144, 31.39% assist percentage.
Dude, you know, we were just talking about Rondo yesterday and wondering what the hell was going on when he was getting benched. And there's your answer, Rondo. Just look at that assist percentage of Campaign, MCW, and Jaren Grant. There's your answer.
Absolutely bizarre, but I guess the Bulls were trying to pull something out of their ass and having a guy that at the point guard position that actually could facilitate and pass, and that was one of the big problems with a lot of these guys is that they weren't able to do that at a high clip. Cameron Payne comes in the top 30 since 2009, 2010, by the way. He's at number 30 at 37.10 assist percentage, and that was in two seasons at Murray State from 2013-2014 to 2014-2015. So that's crazy. Cameron Payne was in the top 30 in college basketball in terms of assist percentage. But I just wanted to give that in terms of like all these Bulls point guards that have been on this team over the recent years and where they stacked up in college before. So I wouldn't buy too much into that. So maybe that gives you a little bit more of an assurance.
Moral of the story is let's throw out assist percentage as a stat.
Agreed. At least evaluating them as Bulls point guards. So we won't have to worry about that too much. But the final thing I want to talk about Coby White's game is whether or not you buy stock into how he played in not only the conference tournament but also the NCAA tournament. Because if you look at the game that he played against not only Duke in the conference tournament but also the one he played in against Auburn where UNC was eliminated, not too great of an offensive performance there. 4-for-14 against Duke in the conference tournament, and he was 4-for-15 against Auburn. 0-for-7 from 3 and 0-for-5 from 3 against Duke. So combined over 12. Do you buy much stock into some of these more high-pressured, high-intensity games? Or are you kind of falling in line with what Coles Wicker had told us late last week and saying, I wouldn't buy too much stock into tournament games and all of that? But what do you think about this?
Yeah, I mean, I think I am sharing the opinion that Cole gave us, which is that, like, it's nice to see, and we all know that it does have an effect on people's draft stock. Like, there's no denying that. You know, people were starting to pay attention to Ja Morant because of his insane athleticism and the fact that he looked like one of the best passing point guards that were going to be coming into this class. And then the holdover of those who still didn't know who he was watched the tourney and saw him just, you know, dazzle in a couple of games for Murray State, including an upset in the first round. So we all know that performances in the tourney affect draft stock. Look at Brandon Clark the same way. You know, look at DeAndre Hunter the same way. Maybe a fringe lottery guy, and then the Virginia March to the Title happens, and now Hunter is going to be maybe a borderline top five pick. We all know that that happens. Personally, look, if certain things happen and you say, wow, that guy's got metal, that guy's got stones, whatever you want to call it, because they deliver in those crunch time moments, you can look at that as a positive in the list of intangibles that people go through when they are talking about not basketball technique, X's and O's, skill, and their physical traits and physical abilities. You can put that in the column if you want to. Hey, played big in a big game. But to me, it doesn't carry that much weight because most of these kids are just one-year players at the college level anyway.
I agree with that. And, you know, you think about tournament performances. Sure, you can buy a little bit of stock into that. And like you were saying, like with what Cole was saying too as well, it either helps you in terms of if you play really well, but I don't think it necessarily hurts players if they have bad performances. You know, guys that were already highly ranked, I think it only can help your stock in terms of guys who do have really good tournaments, and you see that kind of happening with a handful of guys. And just because they were more exposed to the tournaments and people were more exposed to their games, and playing in high-pressure situations can, you know, it's hard to quantify that in how, like, clutch, when we were talking about clutch a couple weeks ago, it's hard to quantify that in how do you exactly rank and how do you exactly evaluate that? And I think you're not going to be able to truly evaluate something like that until they get to the NBA level, where the pressure is on almost every night because you're playing against other professionals, and especially when you lead your team to the playoffs. So there probably is a little bit of pressure going into these NCAA tournaments and these conference tournaments, but I always take it with a grain of salt as well. Matt, I wanted to read a couple things for you on Coby White before we get out of here. And this is from Darnell Mayberry about a month ago when he was at the NBA Combine. So it reads like this. Speaking of praise, the point guard who could soon call Chicago home, North Carolina scoring wizard Coby White, receiving a ton of it on Wednesday. White, who measured at 6'5" in shoes, is the all-time leading scorer in the history of the state of North Carolina. Beating out former Bulls second-round pick Jamison Curry, he bumped Michael Jordan from his perch atop UNC's all-time freshman scoring list in March and went on to shatter his mark by almost 100 points. And it says everyone who watched White or played against him raved about his knack for scoring. So I thought that was very, very cool. So all-time leader in scoring in North Carolina, the state of North Carolina, and also bumping off our beloved Michael Jordan as an all-time leading freshman scorer at UNC. So that's pretty good. Those are pretty good praises for a guy that a lot of people weren't talking about at the beginning of the season to blow up the way he did.
It is impressive. I mean, you also have to think about some of the other teammates that freshman Michael Jordan had on that UNC team. So, you know, Kobe White came in as a freshman and was asked to basically like be the guy. So opportunity versus production, you know, you're going to get that. But, you know, it is impressive. And look, you know, I think you talk about the strengths and weaknesses to his game as we've done. And you talk about, you know, if he's there at seven and how Bulls fans would feel about it. I think Kobe White can be a good player at the NBA level. I know he's not as exciting of a prospect as Ja Morant, and I know that even with only five games of Vanderbilt, most people are higher on Darius Garland than they are on Kobe White. I don't necessarily think that that's a, you know, a black and white, you know, easy answer. I think it's debatable. I think he could fit with this roster that we have right now. Would there be some growing pains with him? Absolutely. But you're getting growing pains from most of these players. As I said, most of these lottery guys are one and done year players. And, you know, we just got to wait and see. We're at what, 9 days away now? The NBA draft is a week from Thursday. And if the Bulls take Kobe White, based on who's on the board, I won't be upset about it, but I'll know that he's going to have to do some serious work to make his game really lethal at the NBA level.
I highly encourage anybody out there who had missed this article from the NBA Combine. It's dated May 17, 2019 from The Athletic from Darnell Mayberry, because there's probably 500 words in here talking about a bunch of different analysts and also players that played against or with Kobe White in this one season, and gives you a lot of really good information. But I wanted to read something just because you brought it up about comparing Darius Garland and Kobe White and who might be the better guard when all things are said and done. So here is Jay Billis from ESPN and also a former Blue Devil talking about a Tar Heel. He says, Billis is also one of the few analysts who has White ranked ahead of Garland. This is from Jay Billis. Both of us could see them both 1,000 times, and you'd like one better, and I'd like the other better, and neither of us are necessarily wrong, Billis told The Athletic. They're both in the same range as players. I've seen Garland as high as fourth. I've got him eighth. I've got Kobe White a little bit ahead of him. I like Kobe White a lot. I think I like him. I like them both a lot. White's got more speed and probably a little bit better in transition. Not quite the pick-and-roll decision-maker that Garland is, but can really score. And then, to wrap it up, he says, Darnell asks, does anybody have any concerns about Kobe White? There is one, perhaps one, to which Bulls fans can relate. Coaching. This is from Kenny Smith. Kenny Smith says, and told The Athletic, I think he's been in a great situation with Roy Williams being able to create systems. So you come into the NBA and sometimes the coaching situation, not even just in Chicago, but in other places, could be fluid. That could hurt your career. So I'm hoping that he goes somewhere stable where the coach is stable and he's going to flourish. So if there's one little bit of a worry, that is very, very interesting from Kenny Smith.
I don't see any worries there, Jordan. I know what you're talking about. Pretty sure Jim Boylan is a very stable genius. Very, very stable.
Yeah, and, you know, as long as Kobe White can bring in grit and toughness, you know, and has a really great spirit and has a full heart and, you know, whatever Jim Boylan characterizes Kobe White is in terms of whether he's the new lion of the team like Robin Lopez was or whatever it is. yeah, at least Jim Boylan's going to be around for a little bit, right? Signing that extension. So in terms of stability, probably going to be around a little bit longer, but still probably not the best situation for Kobe White.
Yeah, well, you know, as long as he doesn't show up to the first day of practice with UNC across his chest, you know, that would be an unforgivable faux pas. But, you know, I think I was listening to a couple of sound bites that Zach LaVine gave 670 The Score that were on Twitter yesterday. And he was being asked about, you know, the magnitude of the player that the Bulls might draft at seventh and, you know, what LaVine might be hoping for or expecting. And I thought it was a pretty, pretty wise words from LaVine, basically Not to say the Bulls fans are getting their expectations too high for any of these picks, whoever it might be at seven, if the Bulls keep this pick and stay where they are, and whether it's White or Reddish or Hunter. Zach LaVine was like, look, you know, unless you are a, you know, once in a generational kind of talent that's going to come in and set the NBA on fire right away, you know, we're looking forward to adding another young piece to this roster at seven, but it's not going to be a world changer. You know, we need to get better as a team collectively, and we all need to work on our games this summer, this offseason, and get better as individuals and as a team. And we're looking forward to add talent to this roster, but there's not going to be some miracle answer, whoever it is that we pick at seven. Which I thought, you know, in amidst all this talk, and Bulls fans are talking the draft crazy right now because that's what we have. You know, that's the next thing on the schedule of figuring out what this rebuild is and where it's going. So that's, of course, everybody's obsessed with it in Bulls Nation right now. But, you know, I think Zach, it was offering a good reminder to be like, look, whoever this is that we pick at seven, it's going to take time. Whoever it is, it's going to be a project, and we're going to need to work with them and develop them. And it's, you know, this isn't going to change overnight, and we're not, our team isn't going to change overnight June 20th of next week because we picked this person, and it's not going to wreck our rebuild, and it's not going to completely make our rebuild. Something to keep in, you know, in mind as Bulls fans are just worrying themselves sick over who they take.
Yeah, those are interesting thoughts from Zach LaVine. So we'll touch more on Zach LaVine's interview with 670 The Score later in this week. Also, we'll touch on all of the prospects that the Bulls have worked out so far. Interesting enough that the Bulls have worked out far and few between, or at least met far and few between, with lottery picks, in, as opposed to they are now working out a lot of the second round picks. So over the next week or so leading up to the NBA draft, we'll talk about the guys that the Bulls have worked out, and maybe some guys that are going to be around at that second round pick at 38, and also guys that maybe will go undrafted that the Bulls will invite to training camp. Because always remember that the Bulls have two-way contracts to give out to some of those undrafted players, and the Bulls have had some pretty good success, at least with their undrafted free agent signings, and turning those two-way contracts into actually productive players such as Ryan Arcidiacono or Antonio Blakeney. So the Bulls will still have those two-way contracts to give out. That's why they've been starting to work out a lot of guys that are in between, you know, the second round and going undrafted. So we'll definitely talk about a lot of those guys. But that's going to about do it here on Locked On Bulls. Thank you again to all of our sponsors on today's show. Hotels.com, Untuckit, and Grip 6 Belt. Thanks to Untuckit for sponsoring today's Locked On Bulls episode. If you are looking for a great Father's Day idea, their shirts are specifically designed to look great untucked and feel comfortable at work or on the weekend. No tucking or tailoring required. Go to untuckit.com, promo code NBA to get 20% off. That's untuckit.com, promo code NBA to get 20% off. We're live on Dash Radio, dashradio.com, and the Dash Radio app. On the Nothing But Net channel, live on Dash Radio every Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, 10 a.m. Eastern, 9 a.m. Central Time. Make sure you're subscribed to Locked On Bulls so you get our episodes as soon as they drop. Yes, as soon as they drop. That means subscribing on Himalaya. Himalaya is the best place to get our podcasts. It's free, super easy to use, and has every single podcast you love or you are searching for. They have personally curated playlists made just for you by their expert podcast tastemakers. They have themed collections of shows to help you with podcast discovery. I know that's one of the biggest hurdles with podcasts right now, is being able to discover podcasts, and Himalaya makes it very, very simple for you. You can find everything from comedy to mystery, thrillers, and sports, and every Locked On Podcast Network podcast will be available on Himalaya. You can follow, listeners, you can follow every one of your favorite show, and you can follow the creators of those shows. You can also like and comment on individual episodes. So if you really, really like an episode or you liked something that you heard, similar to our text and voicemail line, you can go on to Himalaya and comment on individual episodes. The very cool thing about Himalaya is their listeners can build podcast playlists by episodes. You can customize a playlist across all different podcasts. So maybe you like something here at Locked On Bulls, but you also like a couple episodes from Locked On Cubs, and maybe you're a huge Iowa Hawkeyes fan, and so you liked the Iowa Hawkeyes Locked On Podcast Network podcast, you can add all of those to your playlist and be able to play those all together and be able to share it too with friends. So if you want to share a handful of episodes with them, you can do it through social text and emails. You can find and download Himalaya on the Apple App Store and Google Play Store. Don't forget to follow Locked On Bulls once you are there. For Matt Peck, I'm Jordan Malley, Bulls Nation. Have a wonderful day. We'll be back tomorrow with a fresh episode. For Jordan and Matt, we are out. Deuces.
Locked On Bulls, a show for the most passionate fan base in the NBA. Hosts Jordan Malley and Matt Peck dive into the best Bulls news and stories around the NBA. Locked On Bulls is live on Dash Radio every Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, starting at 10 a.m. Eastern, 9 a.m. Central. For more content and to stay up to date, head over to LockedOnBulls.com.